This is Wilderness and Wildlife, presented by the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. This is a half-hour program featuring commentaries and interviews with wildlife and wilderness advocates that relate to the natural environment that we enjoy in the wildlands of the West and all across America. I'm your host, Jay Schell. Our guest today is Eric Molvar. He's Executive Director of Western Watersheds Project, a nonprofit conservation group that's dedicated to protecting and restoring wildlife and watersheds all through the American West. Eric's a wildlife biologist with scientific research in behavioral ecology and systems ecology of moose. He spent 10 years as an author of guidebooks to national parks and wilderness areas. One is about Wyoming's Red Desert. He's been a conservation professional for 21 years, working first in BLM wilderness inventory and later on oil and gas issues, sage grouse conservation, large carnivore events, land use planning, and livestock issues. So he has a broad background.
We talked to him last week, and so we're going to be continuing our interview this week.
Well, thanks for having me back on your show, Jay.
I recently saw a statement, maybe you saw it too, by a biologist for the Shoshone Arapaho tribes, and he noted that the removal of wild horses by BLM has allowed for the return of wildlife on the Wind River Reservation. Did you see that?
I did see that news article. I looked for a study behind it to see if it was backed up by any science, and I couldn't find any. But that may well be true. I don't know what the grazing conditions are on the Wind River Reservation, and so I think that I would have to defer to people that know a lot more about that local situation than I do.
Yeah, he was quite elated that natural vegetation and fauna was coming back onto that area where the wild horses have been taken out. So. And then I saw something from the Western Wildlands team in Oregon that was advocating for the responsible management and protection of native species and their habitat, including wild horses. I assume you're aware of that because that's part of your team.
Yes, Western Watersheds Project did join the Oregon Wild Horse Organization and one other group to challenge a 10-year roundup plan for the Tiger and Riddle wild horse herds. And in these cases, both of these wild horse populations are isolated, and their appropriate management level, that's the arbitrary level that the Bureau of Land Management sets to limit the populations to, is well below genetic minimum viable population standards. So there's a concern there that the wild horse populations might be inbred. But for Western Watersheds Project, what we're really looking at is, are these agencies looking at the health of the land and how many wild horses they can sustain, and what are the impacts of the cattle that are also grazing in the Kiger and the Riddle herd management areas? And the answer to that question is the Bureau of Land Management hasn't done a land health assessment for these two areas in many, many years. And during their 10-year plan, when they tried to look at the environmental baseline, they didn't have anything to say about whether the land health in this area was good, poor, or indifferent. And that's a violation of federal law.
Yeah.
These agencies need to look before they leap. So we're taking them to court, and we're challenging their 10-year plan, and we're hoping to drive some more focus on getting the cattle reduced. Because in these wild horse herd management areas, under the federal regulations, and it's 43 CFR section 4710.5, the federal agency has the authority to remove all or a particular class of livestock, either temporarily or permanently, if that would help the wild horse populations. That's an ability that the Bureau of Land Management almost ever exercises, but we'd like to see the agency start taking away the cattle grazing and the sheep grazing first in order to address land health problems, because, hey, these are private corporations that are putting private enterprise on public lands and degrading those lands that are supposed to be for the public enjoyment.
So how about wolves? Do you get involved in wolf issues at all?
Western Watersheds Project is extremely heavily involved in wolf issues, both in the Northern Rockies, along the West Coast states, and also down in Mexican Wolf Range in New Mexico and Arizona.
Oh.
And we are involved right now in multiple lawsuits trying to get wolves relisted in Idaho, Montana, and Wyoming and getting them the federal protection that they need. We're trying to turn the cranks on USDA Wildlife Services, which is the federal government's death squad they send out at the behest of ranchers to kill grizzly bears and wolves.
That's the Department of Agriculture.
We're down in Arizona and New Mexico trying to reform the recovery plan for the rare Mexican wolf so that these wolves, when they travel north of Interstate 40 to try and reoccupy their native range in this area, they could be left alone, because right now the federal agencies along with the states have kind of gotten together and cooked up this backroom deal that says there can't be any Mexican wolves north of Interstate 40, as if Interstate 40 is any kind of valid ecological barrier that would have existed back in the time of Columbus.
Right.
So and essentially, we're trying to get wolves recovered and back into all of their native habitats, not just in the Rocky Mountains, not just in the Cascades and Sierras, but also in the Great Basin states. These wolves would have been native on the High Plains. They would have been native in the deserts, and they are known to have occupied these habitats. They're a missing piece of the ecosystem, and that missing piece of the ecosystem makes those ecosystems poorer, and they make those ecosystems function less well.
Speaking of the wolf issue down in Arizona, is there any prospect of there being wildlife highway crossings that will be constructed there?
There is a really big potential for putting these wildlife overpasses in a whole variety of places. And the state of Nevada isn't a leader in very much, but they've built a lot of these wildlife overpasses over their interstate highways. Wyoming also has built several. So if they can do it in these kinds of conservative states, this is a solution that can be applied in other areas as well. It's good for the economy, because the more cars that crash, the more insurance payments that are put out, the more people that have to go to the hospital, that's a drain on the economy. That is actually a compelling reason for why the federal government, under a law called Safety Lou, which is an acronym, but it's a major federal highway funding legislation, has funded these wildlife overpasses in the past to make the highway safer for people. But it also makes the highways less of a barrier for wildlife migrations.
Right.
And that really helps restore those native migrations, those native movements that really maximize the population size.
There was money in the infrastructure bill for wildlife crossings. Is there a concern that that could be withheld by a Trump administration that opposed that, or do you think that's locked and secure?
Well, certainly, you know, I have been reading some stories that the Trump administration is very interested in trying to open up and maybe repeal some aspects of the IRA, but the highway overpasses for wildlife haven't been one of the main targets that I've heard of, so maybe they will sneak through. I think that this highway overpasses are one of those kind of political issues that nobody actually loses by constructing them. So that makes them very easy to achieve through political processes, regardless of who's in power.
Do you lobby state legislators or just federal?
We focus almost all of our attention in terms of lobbying on the U.S. Congress. We also sometimes work with state game and fish commissions. We sometimes work with other state agencies. On rare occasions, we will engage in lobbying state legislatures, as we have done on behalf of beavers in Oregon, for example. But usually these state legislatures are kind of tough sledding, and quite frankly, you know, they're not nearly as productive. You don't get the bang for your buck lobbying a state legislature that you get from lobbying a federal government, because the states only control small and isolated parcels of land, whereas the federal government has hundreds of millions of acres all across the West that you can influence.
So do you attempt to influence or work with farmers and ranchers and businesses throughout the West?
You know, we don't do a whole lot with farmers because farming works almost entirely on private lands. There's really no farming to speak of on public lands because it's simply not permitted. In terms of ranching, the vast majority of cattle production also is on private lands. And so we're focusing on the public lands ranching, which is a tiny sliver. It's only 1.6% of American beef that ever touches a hoof on public lands. So it's really a small fraction, but that's the fraction we specialize, because we're there to restore the public lands, to focus on the native ecosystems there and make them thrive. If there were to be, if we were to wave a magic wand tomorrow and get rid of all the cattle and all the sheep in Western public lands, you would have a huge ecological renaissance. The trout streams would be brimming with fish. The hills and the mountains would be just teeming with elk and deer. And at the same time, economically, the states that are producing these public lands ranching industries wouldn't even notice the difference, because the vast majority of the cattle are being produced on private lands. And very helpfully, about a year ago, the University of Wyoming was commissioned by the National Cattlemen's Beef Association to do a study on how many dollars would be lost economically if you shut down all the public lands ranching. And what they found was that the total economic output of public lands ranching added up to less than one half of 1% of the gross domestic product of Wyoming. And Wyoming isn't exactly the economic juggernaut of the United States. It's one of the poorest states in the country.
So you you've hired some additional attorneys. So what's the kind of lawsuits are you engaged in right now?
We have a whole variety of lawsuits all across the West. We have one lawsuit that's challenging the Bureau of Land Management's continual kicking the can down the road on environmental assessments for grazing permit renewals that could have nationwide impacts. We have a lawsuit that is challenging the multi-state habitat conservation plan for desert tortoises and other rare desert animals in southern Nevada that involves the failure of the Bureau of Land Management to take Cliven Bundy's illegal trespassing livestock off of Gold Butte National Monument. They're still there, illegally grazing. We have a lawsuit on Point Reyes National Seashore challenging the National Park Service for authorizing heavy livestock overgrazing that is causing all kinds of stream and beach pollution. It's causing all kinds of ecological destruction, and it's keeping the very rare tule elk, which is a small subspecies of elk found in that area, penned up on an almost waterless peninsula. We're challenging all these different things. In addition, we have a number of Endangered Species Act lawsuits challenging the failure to list species ranging from wolves to Arctic grayling, and we're looking at pygmy rabbits, the very rare Kings River perg, a spring snail that's threatened by the Thacker Pass lithium mine in Nevada. So across the board, we're a big player in protecting and restoring endangered species as well, with litigation and court action.
I assume that the Department of Justice represents the agencies that you're suing. So is that correct?
It is the Department of Justice that is our adversary. We almost exclusively sue against federal agencies. We almost never sue against individual corporations or individual businesses. It's always suing the federal agencies for violating their own federal laws and their own federal regulations when authorizing private uses of public lands.
So do you feel that the Department of Justice is vigorous in their opposition to your lawsuits, or is it fairly perfunctory?
Well, you know, I think if you look at the fact that we win maybe 85% of the lawsuits we bring, that's a pretty high winning percentage, and that gives the Department of Justice a pretty high losing percentage. So I don't know what that says about their attorneys and their motivations and their abilities, but what it does say is that Western Watersheds Project attorneys and also the pro bono law firm attorneys that sometimes represent us, like Advocates for the West, like Earth Justice, like Western Environmental Law Center, are doing a very good job.
Well, the Trump administration apparently is going to clean out Department of Justice, and I'm just thinking that your opposition there, the attorneys there might be less inclined to oppose you than strenuously than previously. So maybe for you it's a good turn.
Well, you know, every time a president tries to gut federal agencies, it sows chaos in the ranks, and it destroys the agency's ability to function.
Right.
And to the extent that we're suing these agencies because they're doing bad things, maybe they'll be less able to do bad things on public
lands. Right. So how about renewable energy? Do you encourage renewable energy projects on public lands like windmills and solar panels?
We encourage renewable energy development in urban areas on rooftops and on shade canopies above parking lots.
Uh-huh.
We can produce basically all of the electricity that America needs. Scientific studies show this by putting up solar panels on all the available rooftops, and that doesn't even count putting solar panels in interstate highway medians, over shade canopies, over parking lots, over canals. There are some completely ecologically useless areas where we can put this renewable energy production. It's a big mistake to make major utility scale, industrial scale renewable projects, converting public lands from viable wildlife habitats to industrial areas. That makes no sense at all. That was a big mistake by the Biden administration. What they should have been doing was much more of the several billion dollars in the Inflation Reduction Act to put solar panels up in the cities where the electricity is actually being used.
Yeah.
Because not only do you have less of an environmental impact, but you also don't have to construct multi-billion dollar transmission lines
all right.
to get the electricity from some remote area into the urban area where the electricity is actually going to be useful.
Do windmills affect wildlife?
Windmills can have a pretty significant impact on wildlife, especially birds.
Bats.
Bats as well.
Yeah.
And these flying animals can't see the windmill's turbine blades spinning, and so they fly through the path, and they can get chopped up. And that is a particularly major concern for golden eagles, because golden eagles often are in the kinds of habitats that you have wind farm development, like South Central Wyoming. And there are real concerns among biologists that in certain parts of South Central Wyoming, which is right now kind of the heartland for golden eagle surviving populations, we're going to wipe out the entire golden eagle population with all the wind farms we're building.
Wow.
In addition, there has been a study that was done in the Shirley Basin of Wyoming that found that wind farm construction drove pronghorn off of crucial winter ranges where they previously got their winter feed and moved them off onto more marginal landscapes. So we have to keep to worry about the impacts of wind farms on things like pronghorns, on things like elk, on things like sage grouse, in addition to the birds that are flying out there in the air.
Do you have any actions going in regard to oil and gas drilling?
We just won a major lawsuit in southeastern Wyoming, stopping the 5,000-well Converse County project. So that's a big one. That's one of the four biggest victories that's ever been one against a major oil and gas field development in the western United States in history. So we just won a really big one. We've also continued to focus on oil and gas leasing in sage-grouse habitats. I think when the Trump administration gets into office, they've announced that energy dominance is one of their main focuses, and they are focusing on maximizing the production of fossil fuels, which have a huge climate impact and also have a huge impact on lands and wildlife and native ecosystems. So we see a likelihood that the environmental community writ large and Western Watersheds Project will probably play a small role in this as well. We'll have to rise to the challenge and fight against some of this development in the coming 4 years.
It'll be interesting to see how, now that Elon Musk is involved with his electric cars, how that policy is somewhat mitigated. That'll be an interesting thing to follow. So
it will be an interesting thing to follow, but what's really interesting is that Elon Musk is going to be appointed as co-head of a new department on economic efficiency and cost cutting. And one of the biggest economic efficiencies on Western public lands is leasing out public lands for livestock grazing, because we're only charging $1.35 an animal unit month for a cow-calf pair to be on the land for a month.
Uh-huh.
And that compares to $24 a month to graze that same land if it's private.
Wow.
So we're not charging fair market value for renting out our public lands for livestock grazing. Maybe they will level the playing field between private and public lands.
That's pretty interesting, yeah. Do you have any favoritism in regard to the crops that are grown on agricultural property?
Well, certainly, on private lands, we don't really focus much at all on what happens in farming. And most of those crops are non-native species, often genetically modified species anyway. Single crop monoculture has no ecological value to native wildlife. So really, that's kind of a death zone for wildlife species. But on public lands, we really have a very strong focus on only allowing the use of native seeds and native types of plants for revegetation. And this is really important because the Bureau of Land Management and other federal agencies have long preferred to use non-native invasive species like Siberian wheatgrass, like crested wheatgrass, like forage kochia, which are popular with livestock producers because cattle will eat them, but they're worthless for the native wildlife.
Mm.
And so they create an ecological desert when you plant them, and they create a long-term weed infestation that is really hard to get rid of. So we have been pushing very hard to convert over to native seed production, and Western Watershed Project was able to get $275 million in federal appropriations in federal legislation passed through Congress and approved that now is going to fund the establishment of centers to develop native seeds, so there won't be this scarcity of native grasses when the BLM has a fire and they're going to do broadcast seeding by flying over the area and dropping out a bunch of seeds.
What was the litigation you were involved in southern Idaho?
One of the lawsuits that we were involved in southern Idaho was against the Caldwell Canyon phosphate mine, which was the feedstock for Roundup. And of course, since our lawsuit, the Bayer Corporation and the Monsanto, who had bought Monsanto, has decided to switch from phosphate-based glyphosate to another possibly equally bad chemical, but that, moving away from using the phosphate mining as a basis for Roundup. But the key piece of that litigation was that the Bureau of Land Management authorized this mine to have a road that was built right next to a sage grouse lek. And the agency argued that, this sage grouse lek isn't considered to be an active lek by Idaho Game and Fish Department. But according to its own sage-grouse plan definitions of what constitutes an active lek, this was an active lek. And the judge busted them for that and basically overturned the mine approval process and halted the phosphate mining in its tracks, also noting that the agency had failed to consider the cumulative effect, not just of the Caldwell Canyon mine, but of the dozen or more other phosphate mines together on the East Idaho upland sage-grouse population, which has been doing very poorly. So it's a really important ruling.
What are the other organizations that you partner with on various kinds of projects?
Well, you know, it really depends on the project because, you know, when you look at lawsuits that we either lead or participate in, we almost always have other co-plaintiffs. Sometimes it's organizations like Wild Earth Guardians or Center for Biological Diversity or the Sierra Club. Sometimes it's organizations like Alliance for the Wild Rockies or Wilderness Workshop. Sometimes it's animal welfare organizations that we sometimes partner with, like Trap Free Montana or Animal Welfare Institute. So it really, you know, it's a different suite of players depending on what legal chessboard we're playing on.
And how does Western Watersheds get public support?
We are funded almost entirely by private donations and often from major donors. We receive almost no funding at all from big foundations where you apply for the grant and there's a competitive grant process. And there's a reason for that. These big environmental foundations tend to be really political, and they really don't like hard-heading groups like Western Watersheds Project that will sue the federal government even when there's a Democratic administration in office. So, you know, we have the guts to stand and fight for the public lands, regardless of who's in office and who's in power. And the people in the West that want to have healthy public lands and want to have abundant wildlife and fish populations really appreciate that. And it's their generosity that makes our work possible.
So people can get more information about Western Watersheds by going to your website. What is that?
Our website is www.westernwatersheds.org, and you can also find us on social media platforms like Facebook and Instagram.
Oh, neat. Okay. Very good. Well, Eric, believe it or not, we've ran out of time, but I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you. It's been really great, really interesting, and I really, really want to thank you very much.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to share our perspectives with you.
Okay. Our guest today has been Eric Mulvar. He's Executive Director of the Western Watersheds Project. And this has been Wilderness and Wildlife, a presentation of Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. Thanks. If you'd like more information or to hear some of our previous interviews, look up kgvm.org and check it out. Scroll down to Wilderness and Wildlife, and you'll find some other interesting interviews. Thanks for listening. I'm Jay Schell. Bye-bye.